This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Lewis Scooter Libby is found guilty of perjury in his criminal trial and why one study says most women prefer male bosses. Joining us on the panel are E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. So welcome all, and of course the country is abuzz with news of Dick Cheney's former chief of staff. Lewis Scooter Libby was convicted on 3 counts of perjury and a 4th count of obstruction of justice. The conviction stemmed from an investigation into the leak of CIA operatives' identity, Valerie Plame. Libby's attorney, Ted Wells, says they were obviously unhappy with the jury's decision.
Despite our disappointment in the jurors' verdict, we believe in the American justice system, and we believe in the jury system. We intend to file a motion for a new trial, and if that is denied, we will appeal the conviction, and we have every confidence that ultimately Mr. Libby will be vindicated.
Now, if that appeal fails, Libby could face up to 30 years in prison. Valerie Plame's husband, a former U.S. ambassador, Joel Wilson, told the CBS Early Morning Show today that they're moving ahead with a civil suit. A question remains on the table: who knew what and when? ER, goodness,
yes.
I'm starting out this morning, it's snowy, what can I say? ER, will we ever know that?
Well, first, Faraya, I think we're forgetting that most people don't even know what this case is about. It is so convoluted on one level. It is simple on another. On one level, it shows that the Bush administration would go to any ends to try to sully the reputations of anybody who disagreed with the buildup to go to war in Iraq, and that's what this is about. It has all kinds of other issues involved, including freedom of the press and the right of reporters not to disclose their sources. But it comes down to, in the end, Mr. Libby being caught lying to protect his bosses, including Vice President Dick Cheney. Now, for most people in the United States, none of this is relevant. For those of us who focus a lot on politics and on journalism, it is very, very important. So I hope we don't overblow it because we're interested in it. In the long-range view of things, Libby's conviction means nothing. We know that in the end, he will get a very light sentence, if any, and or he'll be pardoned as President Bush leaves office.
Now, John, do you agree with that assessment? First of all, the assessment that the case is really about the underlying issues and not the issue of perjury. Secondly, that Scooter Libby is going to walk away one way or the other.
Well, I would say that it certainly is not inconceivable that with the level of his counsel and the way these things usually play out, that he might walk away. There might be some symbolism involved here. But the case is really interesting to me because what we're seeing is that this administration is quite Machiavellian, quite systematic, and in itself good at that, in pushing forth this effort, which they knew would be unpopular in many influential quarters, and doing everything that they can to make sure it happens. I remember reading Joseph Wilson's editorial in The Times way back about 4 years ago and thinking, what is the administration going to do to counter this very prominent egg that has been thrown into its face? And look what happened, and Libby is obviously taking the fall. And ER is right, that to most of the country, this is a white man in a suit being, tortured in Washington about something that is rather complicated and doesn't have much to do with putting groceries on the table. But in fact, it's interesting to me because though we are trained to see him as this poor, evil person, if all of these Machiavellian things were being done for something that we happen to agree with the larger contours of, I think we might see him as kind of a martyr. I have seen such cases in other situations.
Martyr?
I remember when I was, very briefly, when I was at UC Berkeley, there was one professor there, Latino for the record, who lied about having let some athletes in with very low grades because he thought that they deserved to go to Berkeley even though they did not have the test scores to show it. He lied about it. It was revealed. He suffered some kind of rebuke, and he was seen in exactly the same pose that Libby is on front of the Times today as a kind of a martyr by good-thinking people. And so, to me, it's just a matter of what your truth conditions are, and these people's truth conditions are that this war is a correct thing, which are not
now,
like truth.
Now, John, if I'm getting you correct, you're also implying that if most Americans agreed that the war was a good thing, then there might be more sympathy for Scooter Libby.
I am not implying it. I'm saying it, yes.
Definitely. Okay, there we go. Jeff, you know, what about the underlying issues? The underlying issues that are behind this case really have to do with government accountability and how we got into this war. Are those underlying issues going to be aired?
I think they're being aired now in this conversation, but I don't think they're going to be aired in the larger conversation. I think we're becoming fixated on whether or not, and when I say we, I mean in general, the mainstream, we're becoming fixated on whether or not Scooter Libby is going to serve his maximum sentence. He's going to get a minimum sentence. He's eventually going to have his name clear. And we're actually missing what this is about. This is really about retribution and what happens when, in this case, an Ambassador Joseph Wilson accuses the administration of doctoring up their intelligence prior to the war in Iraq, and what happens as a result. And that is that, guess what? We're going to find a way to leak your wife's identity. We're going to find a way to out a CIA operative and put that person in danger, because this is what happens when you mess with the big boys. And I think that's what happens. Another point to point out about this particular situation is that it's actually quite sad, because there won't be any more indictments around this case, which means we'll never know who it was that really revealed the operative's identity. There won't be any real punishment for the actual leak itself. So Scooter Libby will be the fall guy, and to add to what John said, in many circles will be seen as a hero because he protected the interests of national security.
And protected Vice President Cheney.
Indeed.
And possibly the president.
Indeed.
And the Vice President said he was very disappointed with the verdict. Is there going to be any kind of further investigation, you think? Not necessarily, as you pointed out, there's not going to be any more indictments, but there's still a civil suit, a civil trial. Will there be more of an airing of the chain of command that may have led to these leaks?
Probably, but in the civil court, it's a little bit different. It's not as glamorous as the criminal court. And accountability, of course, they have more room to be able to explore things. But I think that this is going to be a dead issue.
A lot of this is going to come out in the memoirs, I suspect. We're going to have to wait. People are going to wait until somebody has died down.
The memoirs, the movie, and the presidential library. We have all sorts of opportunities that might not take effect for another couple years. Anyway, in case you're just tuning in, you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've got John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow in Public Policy, E.R. Shipp, Professor in Journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. And ER, I gotta bring this one to you.
It's
all about the boys and the girls. So all this month on News and Notes, we're talking to women in leadership positions. In fact, tomorrow we'll hear from Geraldine Ferraro. But right now I want to talk about why women may prefer men to take the lead in the workplace. There was a study done by Elle Magazine and MSNBC.com, and it showed that 3 out of 4 women would rather have a male in charge. The report said that women were more weary of dealing with the stereotypical catty boss lady. What are we to make of our own kind, ER?
Well, it's not unlike how we look at our own kind racially. We have been trained over the decades and over the centuries to look upon ourselves in negative ways. So that survey showed that women saw that other women were moody, bitchy, gossipy, emotional, catty. Those are all words that have been used over the centuries to downplay our roles in society. Women have made that a part of their own identity. to look at other women in that way, just as I think we're seeing with Barack Obama's campaign. We're seeing some of that same kind of thing coming out with the way black people see themselves, that they can't do, they can't be. It is sad. We're in the 21st century, and we're still stuck with 1700, 1800, 1900, you know, ideas about ourselves.
Jeff, I'm thinking of the movie The Devil Wears Prada and the stereotypic witchy boss. Why do you think women prefer male leadership, according to this study at least?
Well, I guess according to the study, I think that it speaks to the old notions of America, and whether it's the Ozzie and Harriet Leave It to Beaver notion of this man going out and winning the bread and a woman staying home and baking cookies and putting them on the windowsill and,
the children looking up.
Oh, or wearing pearls, et cetera. I think it buys into that notion, and it buys into that notion not just for women, but for everybody. So the minority, the racial minority in America, all of us, we look to this ideal of leadership as being a white male, whether it's a presidential leadership, a corporate leadership, a political leadership, whatever it is, we look to that. And I think that it affirms that we still have this notion. So when you have the white male as the center, as the leader in every kind of context, then what happens is there is a development of a low self-esteem collectively in everybody who is under that, in that hierarchy. And what happens is if you're under that, guess what? You attack everything that looks like you, because in actuality, you're expressing your own self-hatred. So you hear that when you talk about minorities in the workplace. They have we have the crab in the barrel mentality sometimes when we see another minority elevated. The same thing happens with women. You hear the word catty in this study, women describing other women as catty 347 times. That's amazing. I've heard it a lot when I talk to other women who talk about this whole notion of following another woman leader. I think that it's also interesting to point out, though, with hope in the future, that younger workers 18 to 29 had a greater preference for the female leaders. So I think young people in each generation think differently, but it's a painstaking process of slow growth for a future that will allow us to look at women equally in the workplace.
So, John, when you think about the public policy implications of this, is this really going to put the brakes on any kind of real gender equality in leadership? Not just men putting the brakes on, not just men building the glass ceiling, but women building a glass ceiling.
Yeah, it's there a little bit. And I think that all signs are that it's quite possible to surmount these things partly through this kind of awareness raising, kind of like black issues. We're talking about these obstacles, these internalized stereotypes, and they're there. I've known many young women who have gone out into the world quite impatient with what they regard as an antiquated feminist rhetoric, having never experienced anything they would consider sexism, and finding that, yes, there definitely is something there. Now, their attitude towards that is to stiffen their backs and to work against it, not to become professional victims. But nevertheless, we need to know that it's there. I think, for example, that 97% of the visceral hatred that Hillary Clinton evinces from a certain crowd is because she's a woman, a man, the exact same person, but a man would just be seen as strong. She's seen as a B-H, I think, because of that. There are things to think about. We're in a transitional stage.
Well, speaking of slurs against people, DJs seem to be going after Barack Obama. Sometimes these radio shock jocks will
this
cross the
ridiculous
line. That's why we got to bring it up. A Texas DJ called the presidential hopeful a clean darkie. He explained it was part of an on-air conversation about Joe Biden's comments on the cleanliness of the senator.
He was making fun of Biden.
Yeah, that's what he says.
That's what I thought.
It was in quotation marks. I think we have to read that one in context. He was on our side. The disc jockey, he was making fun. He was quoting Biden in a way by saying clean darkie. He is on our side as black people. He thought it was a wrong thing to say. It was a joke. I hope we're not going to misread him as saying Barack Obama is a clean darkie. That's not what he meant. We have to attend to context, don't we?
The question is, go ahead, ER.
I would say we don't really have to pay attention to it at all. But this points out that with the rising star of Barack Obama, we're getting everything from left, right, up, down that he's having to deal with. Is he black enough? Is what some black people have asked. Is he too black? Which is what some white conservatives have asked. Did he diss his minister by not allowing him to come to his announcement ceremony? Does he have slaves in his background, his family being owners of slaves? Everything is coming out reminding us that race is so close to the top level of our lifestyles in this country. And through Obama, we're being forced to think about it. So if you think you're telling a joke, you got to be aware that it's not going to necessarily fly, because we haven't quite got there yet. Laugh about this stuff.
That really goes back to what John was saying, because he was saying, look, this was embedded in a joke, but the DJ got suspended. Jeff, do you think that that was a good decision?
No, I don't. I think in this particular, see, I'm the first one that's going to jump on somebody for saying something wrong. We can go at it. But I think the question is intent. Was he saying it tongue in cheek? And it sounds like he was casting aspersion on Biden more than Obama. The other thing is, we get peeved off about words, and in this case, darky, that's used tongue in cheek, while other words like discrimination, hatred, oppression, economic inequity, and many other big, beautiful words get acted out every single day in the society. We don't get peeved off enough to attack them in mentality or institution. So I think the NAACP is barking up the wrong tree in this particular case. So I think they should reprioritize.
Well, the NAACP doesn't even know where it's going these days. Their leader said he's sick of them himself and stepped down on Sunday. It was formally announced. So we can't just look to the NAACP. We've got to think about what are the priorities here. And more of these kind of stupid things are going to be said and acted upon because Obama is running and he is black, and because Hillary Clinton is running and she is a woman.
All right, we're going to leave it there, and I'm sure we're going to come back to these topics again and again over the coming months. E.R. Shipp, professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication. She was joining us by telephone in this naughty, naughty weather. John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute senior fellow in public policy at our New York bureau. Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle at Nashville, Tennessee's Spotland Productions. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks, Farai.
Next on News and Notes, two books that take on the legacy of lynching: On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, and the novel Like Trees Walking.